The Disruption, a lively discussion between UVA Darden School of Business professors Yael Grushka-Cocaine and Mike Lennox on cutting-edge technologies and practices that are challenging the status quo.
Hey, Mike, how are you doing?
Yael, great to be back with you in the studio.
I know, I've missed you.
I know, I've seen you between the times
you've
been in
the
studio.
I know, that's true,
You know, but it has been a couple months in which we've been here. So I thought I'd start with just observing that in the last few months, thankfully, AI has not gained sentience and decided to destroy the human race. So that's good. On the downside, it seems like humans are pretty good about doing this to other humans, but
yes,
we don't need to go onto those topics today.
Yes, and it is true that I'm excited to be here because we haven't talked, and yet so much has happened in even such a short amount of time in terms of disruption around us, and technology just keeps surprising us every single day. So I'm excited for our conversation, and I know that it's going to generate even many more conversations down the road.
I think absolutely. Though I do find it funny with the where we are in the hype cycle, especially around AI now, and the way people are acting as if it just came out of nowhere in the last year here, where clearly we both know this has been decades in the development. But it's at one of those points, clearly, where it has caught the public's imagination and everyone is scrambling to figure out what should we do about this?
Exactly. And you and I kind of, I think, date back in a similar fashion. And we remember moments like this in our past where there was a hype around the dot-com boom and the internet. There was a hype around everything to do with IMs and chatting and online synchronous discussion. There was all kinds of peak moments. And this seems like it's another very big game-changing moment in general, in the world, let alone for business.
Do you think it's moving faster? Everyone feels like it's moving faster. And I think about, we've only been doing this podcast for, a couple of years now.
Right.
And there's been the hype cycle around crypto. There was the hype
rise
cycle
and fall,
around the rise
yes.
and fall of crypto. We could probably revisit that one at some point. The metaverse,
yes.
was all the rage there for
NFTs,
a little while.
Yes.
They're still out there.
Yes.
Do you think it's accurate that things are moving faster now?
Either that or I'm moving slower. And I know that that's definitely true. So. It could be that that's just the sentiment that we get over time. But there is something to be said just technically to the fact that, yes, innovation probably is moving faster. The world is connected more than it ever has been connected before. And therefore, when there is a new discovery, it's instantaneously in the hands of everybody, not just in one pocket of the world.
It does remind me, in our lifetimes, the things and the technologies we've experienced. At the UVA football games, they have this fun little video they do now where they ask current football players, what is this object? So my favorite was they showed him an Atari, and the response was, is that an answering machine?
Yeah.
I had no idea what a pager was or a fax machine. So clearly, technology does evolve.
There you go. Well, today we're going to kind of revisit a topic, or I'll be curious to chat with you and with our expert around a topic that we've talked about before. But as you said, the hype around AI these days is especially felt around the notion of generative AI. We've talked about generative AI. We've talked about it in the arts. We've talked about it in the music. We've talked about it in writing. But it has ceased to calm down. And actually, we're now learning to live our lives with generative AI. And so we're coming back to revisit generative AI.
Yeah, and obviously, this is a topic that's constantly in the news. And I think what's fascinating is where we're seeing it manifest itself, especially with some of the strikes we've seen in the media sector, with the writer's strike and the actor's strike, and how central this question about generative AI is to those debates and discussions moving forward.
So can we talk a little bit about why they're striking and what it is that they're striking about and how AI comes to play? Because I don't know that we always equate, unions or organizations and strikes with a technology or a disruptive technology necessarily. Usually it's about, conditions of work and more pay. So what exactly is at the heart of it right now? Shall we chat about that a little bit?
Absolutely. I mean, again, I'm not claim no expertise in this field and their negotiations, but the sense I get is, those again who are superstars, right? Let's talk about movie actors and the like. They do quite well. But they're just the top of the pyramid of a vast industry. And there are lots of actors and actresses who are spending their time, you know, those little bit roles, you know, maybe being an extra on the set and the like. And I would imagine that's where a lot of the fear is. You know, it's been true for decades that there are scenes in which we observe in movies. I think about things like the Lord of the Rings series going back where, you know, all those orcs weren't people in costumes, right? A lot of those were computer generated. And so this idea that with the technology as it's evolving, more and more of those actors are going to be AI and generated seems like a reasonable concern.
Okay, so fascinating. So one, maybe there are concerns around the fact that there will be more computer and technology generated roles and less roles for individuals to make money off of. And that actually is interesting because we talked about that fear when we were, had concerns around who composes music and how AI might affect, you know, certain industries where there's a lot of bread earners at the level that create content for, let's say, jingles and you know, marketing movies and the like. So I understand that fear. I actually think that it's something even deeper here that not only relates to the actors and the writers in Hollywood, but it relates to all almost every one of us, is that some of what we're seeing with AI and all the hype around and the promise that generative AI brings is we have to remember that the training of these models was done on data and on, you know, content that was out there in the internet or sphere, but nobody asked anybody else's permission. We post things all the time, and we don't think that somebody eventually will be making money off of it, and that kind of raises some very interesting ethical questions.
Yeah, especially, you know, as creators, you know, people putting things kind of in the public domain. That's by the nature of what you do. What are the rights and responsibilities that you have once you've put something in the public domain? You know, we can train a voice AI on someone in literally a matter of seconds at this point. You know, what does that mean if you are doing a podcast, for example?
Exactly.
Is somebody going to deepfake our podcast here?
How would we feel about it? And so I think that that is at the heart of this question where consumers and content creators of all sorts are suddenly just recognizing that they need to be more aware of what gets done with their content. They need to think about the approval. And on the other hand, the tech companies, and not only the tech companies, I don't want to make them you know, the scapegoat here, but organizations are also leveraging the technology and running with it because they're excited about the opportunities, recognizing maybe a little bit after the fact that there are some complexities there on what was used in the training of those models.
Yeah, and I've said on this podcast before, to be a little too cute, you know, technology always wins. It's really hard to arrest the development of a technology like this, and how do we adjust to it, I think is what we're all grappling with now, and especially again on some of these critical issues around intellectual property and content creation. You know, I don't know if we'll get a resolution anytime soon, but we're clearly having it in the forefront, and the legal environment is now trying to figure this out.
And their role. So as we discuss this, it's kind of interesting to know and to think about who exactly are the strikes against, or who are they negotiating with? Because like anything else, when there's somebody striking, they're trying to get the attention of some other counter party. In this case, it's primarily some of the, I mean, I guess that there's two outlets or two bodies that are expected to intervene. One is the studios themselves, when actors or writers, and while the writers' strike kind of ended recently, the actors' strike is still ongoing. Really what they want to ensure is that when they participate in a new production, there are some guarantees that whatever went into that production doesn't then get utilized in a way that they didn't authorize. Yeah. And so, and I can imagine that that would be a very important part of their job, that I now walk into the studio, I don't only care about this specific production, but I also want to make sure that whatever I bring to the table doesn't then get trained in a, you know, a large language model train or some kind of model, get trained on my voice, my image, my you know, my persona and everything that I put into it, and then gets utilized in a brand new production that I didn't even approve.
And what I worry about with this stream of thinking is I think when it comes to your own individual identity, especially if you're a name, you know, brand actor or writer or the like, clearly there's going to be need to be some reckoning about deepfakes as we've talked about them before. I worry, though, that I think a lot of what's going to happen in these studios is they're going to create people out of nothing, if you will, like new actors that we haven't seen before that are built off of a wide number of other previous actors
some
or
new
voices.
Jack Nicholson, Meryl Streep hybrid.
That's a scary thing to think about what that would look like. But
you got all future Oscars go to that person.
Yeah. Right. And that is where I think it gets challenging. Because let's take large language models in general. You know, they are working because they are being trained off of massive data sets. They're not training it off of my writing. They're training it off of thousands, millions of people's writing. And so whose voice are they taking from? And we've discussed before in the context of music, you could argue that all music that is advanced is, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants where you're taking bits and pieces from Dylan or pick your favorite artist and pulling it together. I think that's going to be very hard to make content-based claims if I am one of a million people you trained your AI on. Right. And again, I think that maybe would be my bigger fear for these actors and actresses is it's not they're going to copy you. They're going to create something new based on you and a million other actors or writers and the like.
That is a totally fair point and a very interesting aspect and dimension to this conversation. I just want to also briefly add that another kind of body or another outlet that is being called upon to intervene and to join the conversation are the policymakers.
Yeah.
We know that there have been questions, and you and I have talked about it in the context of business and how policy in Washington is trying or does it stand a hope to put some guardrails around the development of generative AI and the deployment of generative AI in the wild? I know that you're quite skeptical, but the Actors Guild and the other organizations are hoping that there will be some centralized effort, especially as we think about it, like they've intervened before, like against piracy, for instance.
Yeah. Well, again, my skepticism comes from, you know, all the calls for regulating AI. I have seen very little specifics on what exactly are you talking about. And you often see, you know, data ownership being raised. But to the same point I was making about how you train on these large data sets, again, what exactly are you saying here? I think typically when the technology is moving quickly, it is very hard for the policy and regulatory frameworks to keep up with it. It's not that they won't eventually, but again, I'm not seeing clear ideas of even what those regulatory interventions would actually be.
And by the time they get developed, the technology will be five steps ahead.
Yeah. I think it's probably time for us to bring in our expert for today, because I know I'm at my extent of being able to talk about.
We have only concerns. We have no answers.
Yes, exactly. So hopefully Anthony will provide us with all the answers today. So I'm really pleased that we have our colleague and friend here, Anthony Palumba, who's an assistant professor here at the Darden School. He teaches leadership communication, but he also teaches storytelling with data, which I think is such an important skill these days. And in his research, he explores how and why audiences consume entertainment. And he is just one who, you know, you see quoted in the press all the time because he is so in touch with the AI aspects, the data aspects, and just what's happening more broadly in the entertainment sector as it relates to technology. So really,
we couldn't have been this lucky to have such an expert in the house.
Exactly.
Right?
So Anthony, are you there with us?
I sure am. That's quite an introduction. I'm kind of looking behind my shoulder. I'm also excited to meet this person. So thank you very much for the introduction.
Well, I'm humbled. You're too modest. Maybe to start off with, because you've been paying close attention to the writer strike and the actor strike, can you tell us where, I guess, the writer strike now sits and how they resolved to the best they could some of these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's kind of serendipitous also that the strike happened just as ChatGPT had been introduced into the public eye some 6-8 months prior, right? So it was kind of kismet in that, and it forced creatives to kind of reconcile these issues, whereas I don't know that this was the primary intention. Just to give it a little bit of context, there was a massive, massive fight over residuals, which also incidentally is related to AI and of course the exploitation of content repeatedly. The WGA has settled, to answer you, Mike and Yael. They have settled, and writers are able to, you know, use AI, but it's at their behest. The studios cannot force their hand to do so. If there's anything that is informed by AI and a writer has to supervise it, work with the content, otherwise it can't be exploited. And it's already been, at least for now, jurisprudence that anything developed by AI is not eligible for copyright protection. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's kind of a stopgap. But I think, Mike, to your point, I'm also a little bit skeptical because the WGA's contract is only for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And at first, when I read that, I said to myself, oh, what were they thinking? I was like, oh, I know exactly what they're thinking. They want to come back in 3 years because they're also not satisfied with whatever the elements or conditions are of the contract to say, listen, guys, we're going to have to talk in 3 years because we're not even sure if we're going to be fully protected and happy with what we have here. There also is a minimum of the amount of writers in a room as well. And so there are some protections. Incidentally, the last thing I'll mention here is there's a 13% wage increase over a 3-year span. But those of us who have gone through the pandemic and recent inflation, which I imagine is everybody on this podcast, readily recognizes that interest rates have been through the roof so much that parsing out 13% over 3 years is nice, but nice in a way that allows them to kind of go along and maybe kind of still stay afloat in expensive LA and other places, but you know, is not indicative of the current economic climate.
So maybe not a big win here for the writers at this point. I'm curious, Anthony, on the idea of the use of, let's say, ChatGPT or generative AI. So if I'm a writer now, I use ChatGPT to give me, let's say, a first draft. I then begin to manipulate it. At what point can I get copyright on it?
That's the thing that's come out with these conditions in the contract. You know, a lot of the streaming services said that they would begin to give ratings information to creatives so they know how successful their shows are. Nobody knows what that means. And nobody knows what it means if a writer is part of a script, to what extent is that particular boundary. Mm-hmm. I've been running a study currently that looks at what makes a hit TV series. And I've been talking to writers, directors, and producers all summer. We're hoping to hit about 50 people, 50 creatives. And the conversation has been quite interesting when I bring this up to them. Some writers have used it to kind of, ideate and figure out kind of new different ideas. If there's writer's block, it's a great thing to turn to. Titles, actually, especially from what I'm hearing, are quite useful. And I think what you're hearing here is a nugget, right? What's the nugget? Is there like a little bit that can be expounded upon, or mm-hmm. something that can be ideated by an AI machine? All of this is to say that's what I'm gleaning from how writers are using this. But to answer you specifically, Mike, that is still very, very nebulous and amorphous. And I think it gives credence to why the writers, despite a lengthy and contentious 5-month strike, want to talk in 2026 when the contract is up again.
Now, it's interesting because, you know, it's all like other topics of technology and disruption that we've had on our podcast here, some problems are not new, meaning with new evolution of technologies, the same old problems get revisited. And so I guess when we moved from radio to print to TV, I should say, in terms of like a major kind of public use and advertising channel, it became clear that actors' faces and voices need to have some, you know, the actors themselves need to have some kind of say in who gets to use it and in what way. And there are some states that do have protection in place for the use of somebody's face and voice that they need to offer consent. Aren't we talking about just the same old thing in a new format with a new technology?
I think we are to some extent, because obviously there are IP lawyers who are, you know, salivating and waiting for somebody to violate one of the IP laws that are in place right now, right? To say that, oh, you can't use my client's likeness or image. I think part of the struggle or the strife with this is that if we think of Marlon Brando, we think of Elvis, we think of these larger than life characters who have passed on, or, you know, a James Dean, or even using Tom Hanks, who's still with us, you know, his likeness or image, or a Meryl Streep. What jobs does that take away from somebody who could have been there physically? And I think that's where the contention lies, that it and this is actually something that came out in some of the interviews I've done, is this idea that the circle in the pool gets smaller and smaller, because it's so difficult breaking in, right? Once you're in, man, you're in. And you hear this all the time. Mm-hmm. I've heard this ever since I started studying media doing consulting, whatever it is, once you're in, you're in. But once you're successful, it's the relationships that you have. And so if we know that there's somebody who is a larger than life character, why would I go find a fresh face? Uh-oh. And that's an issue, right? I think of Timothée Chalamet. I think of Zendaya as up and coming actors. Hey guys, who else is there, right? Mm-hmm. And we begin to kind of see a slowdown in hot, hot Hollywood actors and actresses. Margot Robbie comes to mind, but I don't know that she's a spring chicken anymore either.
Right? Oh, wow. Wow.
Barbie.
I think we might be the first podcast that just called out Margot Robbie for being old. That's awesome.
And she's doing tremendous things. Yeah, you raise a good point, Anthony, because I think, again, this is where the good and the bad sides come out of technology. And I will go on the record and state that in the past, I've been in favor of some of these innovations. I think I forecasted that it would be a good disruption. And when I did so, if I kind of bring back to recollection my thinking then and what I feel now, at the same time that it presents some narrowing of the field because creators can just create their new, can rely on old actors and not bring in new faces. At the same time, I do see some kind of democratization of this technology and the access point. And I can see what my son can create on his own computer or like what, just a layperson can do is so much more advanced than before. And access to these tools provides many more people to contribute and generate content. Like every content, everybody can add something to TikTok and become a superstar. Like those two things are happening simultaneously, right? So like, is it always narrowing the field or is it also opening the door to so many more people?
So I also think that there is an opening for a lot of different people. And one thing that I was frankly surprised that wasn't discussed amidst the strike and AI and all of this is, will we need Disney or Warner Brothers in 30 years, right? We look at a lot of these bigger institutions and it even goes to a Deloitte or a McKinsey. If you think about how these places function, they function because they have resources that are untouchable otherwise, right? They're able to make indelible imprints on society in such a fashion that no singular person could. And, the bringing together all of these talents and abilities creates some sort of superstar product or service. If I think about, the technology on my Mac computer, I read this somewhere, it's very similar to the technology that was used for E.T. in the early 1980s. And that's kind of mind-blowing when we think about that because that movie still holds up in a technological aspect, and it's aesthetically gorgeous. The story is very emotional, and it's very, very well done. Who isn't to say that there isn't somebody out there right now who wants to forego Tisch or USC School of Cinematic Arts and say, listen, like I've been coding nonstop. I've been on my computer. I'm making these images. I can make my mother fly around the world or the sky outside my yard if I wanted to.
Right.
Why do I need to go hope that one of these Hollywood actors would like star in my movie? Do I really need that cachet? That's an interesting question.
I mean, is this the end of the unions? And I know that there was this concern when it was launched, the strike, that whether the influencers would join in on the strike or not, because they weren't, some of them unionized and part of this, and some did and some didn't. So can you talk a little bit about like this other world that Yael mentioned here of the influencers and TikTokers and how, is the future, maybe there is no union for these artists?
Yeah, influencers are a really funny thing. They being the Hollywood studios, have tried to have influencers star in movies and TV shows with mixed results. I think on the recent Eddie Murphy movie, Boomerang, I think that was Boomerang 2, they had an influencer on there, and her name is escaping me, but it didn't make a lot of noise, right? And influencers, by and large, make their bread by making noise, not necessarily being skilled for, acting or singing or anything like that, right? And that's where I think there's kind of this misinformation or disconnect perhaps between artists and business people on what does it mean to make art, that you can't package it like you're branding, I don't know why snow peas are coming to mind, guys, or cars or any other
shoes,
product
shoes.
Vertical.
Let's talk about shoes.
Let's go with shoes. Why am I thinking about snow peas? Shoes, cars, right? And so, this, I think, gets to a bigger question of influencers. Are they making art? We know artists make art. What do influencers make? And I think it's kind of amorphous, right? On the one hand, they're selling themselves, they're selling content, they're selling an image for themselves. But on the other hand, it might be a unique personality. They might be more relatable. And, you know, user-generated content tends to create content that, frankly, is more relatable. I can't relate to the Kardashians, but I can relate to probably 95% of people who have posted something on YouTube. Them joining the unions, I think, is a way to kind of bolster the noise. I'll stop with this. You know, if we think about the amount of influencers out there, it's probably, it's close to about 100,000 bona fide influencers. SAG-AFTRA has 115,000 members, by the way, guys.
Yeah.
So that almost, to some extent, means that, you know, actors who really perceive themselves as actors, we have about as many of them as we do influencers, which is cause for optimism, but maybe cause for concern as well with just the, you know, available attention supply.
Well, you really helped me kind of think about something differently or in a new way that I haven't done before, in a way that when I go and watch, and I'm a big fan and consumer of both TV and movies, as some of you know, when I go and watch a show, I look for an actor to act a role. I know it's Meryl Streep, I know it's Jack Nicholson, I know it's Tom Hanks, but they're playing a role and I buy into that and kind of let myself go. When I look on TikTok or Instagram or what have you, the influencers, I'm actually looking for people to be themselves, right? I'm actually not looking for them to act, and I trust them being themselves more than I trust actors who I'm used to putting on a mask and being somebody else trying to sell me a product. So it's a very interesting observation that we're using these audiences differently, and it might imply a different interaction with generative AI, for instance. I think that's kind of helpful, right? For me,
In my mind, you know, not surprising as a business strategist, is going a different direction here, which is, you know, massive lowering the barriers to entry into content creation. And that's been happening for a variety of reasons for a while. And that AI, generative AI, is going to just accelerate that, or at the very least, drastically reduce the cost of content creation. And to your point, like, you know, you might be able to sit at your laptop and make a ET quality a movie. Lots of questions on, you know, writing ability and things like that. But if that's the case, you know, does this undermine the whole business model of entertainment, period? And I know we've been seeing, and I know it's something you look into, Anthony, you know, the streaming model and how all the streamers are struggling to make this profitable. The content creation demands are so huge, so there is a cost associated with that. Maybe the costs are coming down. Whether the consumer is willing to pay a premium for that bundle we call Disney Plus or that bundle we call, you know, Max. How do you see this playing out from kind of a business economic standpoint?
Oh my God, how much time do you have?
We're doing fine. We're doing fine.
Oh my goodness. I mean, first and foremost for your listeners, I mean, the media and entertainment conglomerates, perhaps sans Netflix, are in massive debt. Everybody chased Netflix down the rabbit hole, but Netflix was the thinnest, so to speak, to get out, and everybody else is still in the dark. The debt to EBITDA ratios are disastrous. The amount of money that's been spent alone, and I'll remind your listeners, Amazon spent close to $1 billion for the rights to Lord of the Rings. Universal Pictures just spent $400 million on rights to The Exorcist, which I can go off on what a
interesting choice. Don't hold back. Interesting choice.
Especially just in light of my macro trends with going to church and religious affiliation in the U.S., I'm surprised they thought $400 million for that IP, but that's another story. You know, these media firms right now are struggling. They're struggling with, and I don't mean to keep citing my study I'm currently doing, but it's come out in a lot of different discussions that, at least from the artist's perspective, a lot of executives are ruling from a place of fear and insecurity. So there's a lot of turnover, and a lot of executives are always looking for the next gig because they figure 3 to 5 years, I prove my bread, I move on. And it's difficult when you're producing art, because art on a supply chain, which is a very funny thing to think about, the Mona Lisa or Monet painting on an assembly line, takes a while. We don't see this, though, and that's kind of the issue, right? It's very difficult to really internalize just how long it takes to create and craft something. And so for a lot of these executives, they create a supply chain. Usually it's for IP that's very familiar. And, you know, they try to get some of it out the door. But by the time they leave, well, it's the next Trump's job to kind of fix my mess or whatever I've done, because the next person will figure it out. And so as this compounds over time, yeah, you have this debt issue. Mm-hmm. And everybody thought that, you know, the way to beat a tech giant was to scale like one. And that's what Netflix did, right? Netflix is a tech giant. Tech firms are outfitted to scale. The problem is, can you scale art? And I think that's a really interesting question. There was a Parrot Analytics report, which is a TV measurement firm, and they were looking at outstanding content. And HBO produces way less than Netflix, but by a multiple of seven had more hits.
Right.
Mm-hmm. HBO is MoMA. HBO is the Museum of Modern Art. Let me make sure I'm explaining my acronyms right.
And they've been doing it for a while. They've been around for 30, 40 years doing the same thing, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when you go there, you're going through MoMA, you've got an iced Americano, you're looking at paintings, you're having an intellectual journey, and you're really taking stock of everything. When you think about what's going on elsewhere, it's difficult to see that. You know, it's tough with Netflix or other places in which it's kind of a one-stop shop. And when everybody's a one-stop shop, well, Yael, I don't know what store to go to get anything that.
Right.
This is fascinating, because one of the things I've been saying about generative AI is I don't believe kind of the classic Luddite critique that this is coming for all of our jobs. What I worry about, though, is it's going to make those at the top of the pyramid, you know, 10x or more productive than they are right now. So ultimately, there would be less jobs in these disciplines. And when I think about this, I think of consultants, I think about lawyers, I think about doctors. All of these have the potential here to leverage the technology to do more, to be more productive. But Andy, you're raising a really interesting question, I think, for creatives. Is volume helpful? If Taylor Swift releases 5 albums a year, leveraging AI to support her work, to help write her songs.
She might not be the best example.
Well, let's take
anything
her.
Anything she does, she'll be fine.
Well, that's right. Maybe she could put out 5 albums and it would still be amazing. But you know, thinking about the idea of scarcity here, like, is scarcity actually important in the creative world? And I know this has been, you know, talked about in terms of Marvel and Lucasfilms and Star Wars. Like, have we lost the idea that scarcity and creative content is actually part of its value proposition?
Well, look at what happened with Barbie and Oppenheimer this summer. I mean, one of the arguments is that they were such a slam dunk because of their uniqueness.
Are we going to see like 10 Barbie movies coming out?
No, we are not. I don't believe we are.
Yeah.
What do you think, Anthony?
I mean, I hope not, although there are rumors that Hot Wheels and like 10 other toy franchises are being discussed.
That is fine, but they're not Barbie.
No, they're not Barbie.
Let me ask, maybe as we kind of bring things to a close, there's one angle that we haven't really discussed here that I think will be interesting for us, maybe even to cast our prediction, Mike, in terms of good, bad disruption, and that's from the consumer side of things. Are all of these efforts, or maybe I should kind of rephrase, is generative AI availability in the arts something that the consumers ultimately benefit from? More selection, more opportunity, maybe pushing the HBOs to do even better and be more excellent in their craft. Like, could there be positive outcomes for the consumers of all of these of all of this content?
I think so. And I'm actually going to try to answer both of your questions, because Mike brought up scarcity, and I actually think that's related to what you're talking about, Yael. So scarcity helps consumers because there's only so much that can really dictate pop culture. I know growing up, there were two artists for me that, you know, in the aughts, like whenever they released an album, it was like the sky fell and everything was upside down. And it was Eminem and Lady Gaga, at least for me.
And now I feel very old.
Right, exactly.
He didn't say White Snake and Prince or something.
Yeah. So let me also add, though, I was blasting Def Leppard's Photograph as I was driving here.
Okay, good. Okay, better. That's
so
helpful.
That, you know, beautiful day in Charlottesville. It's either that or some Bon Jovi song. So, but I think with scarcity is necessary when we think about art and we think about pop culture. I think of TRL, I think of Carson Daly, I think of MTV, right? There were only so many artists that could be celebrated that could really be at the forefront of pop culture. So I do think scarcity, Mike, is absolutely necessary when we think of headwinds and what's, you know, trendy or what have you. And this helps the consumer out tremendously. I think, for one, because with so much content, I think what we're finding is consumers are starting to be a bit more sophisticated in where they go, what they look for, and they're starting to be more informed than they probably were, because now they have to be. The onus is on them to be a TV guide. Each one of us now is a walking TV guide to figure out where stuff is and where stuff can be located. And so that's kind of fallen on us.
Right.
I think for consumers, there. Oh, sorry, y'all.
No. I was just saying fascinating. Yeah, keep going.
Yeah. And I think for consumers, if I think about some of the things that can benefit them, you know, creators now can do things that they couldn't before. Right. And so I think about painters 110 years ago who were realists and they were trying to paint landscapes, but they couldn't just nail it. Right. Because of course there are limitations with a paintbrush. Now, given all of the kerfuffle that came along with the camera and painters saying, what the hell are you doing? You know, you're upending our entire industry. Well, why are you taking photos with some sort of booth and you're putting your face under a blanket and you're taking a snap? What are you doing? But now we have an entire industry. And frankly, artists are able to capture things that they just couldn't otherwise. And so I think for consumers, there's an opportunity to have entertainment experiences that I truly think are immersive, I truly think are customizable, that feel and respond to how we are. McKinsey had a report in which, and I've said this for a while, but I'm not, you know, the only person. Emotions, you know, being able to track consumer emotions during a movie. Can you make a movie scarier or less scarier in real time based on the physiological responses of people? That could be cool, right? That could be interesting. Or is it that Kevin Costner wears the Calvin Klein jacket because they know that I wear a Calvin Klein, but Mike sees Tommy Hilfiger and whatever. Like, it's good experiences for both of us. So I try to be a glass half full kind of guy with all of this. And so I think there are a lot of opportunities that I'm not even listing here, frankly, that I think we're going to see.
Do you think, you know, my mind always goes to Black Mirror. They do such a good job, like, hitting some of these trends. And I'm forgetting the name. It's like everybody hates, forget the name of the woman, but it starred Salma Hayek. And it was this idea that we would have incredibly personalized content, right? Like, we would have, like, your own story leveraging generative AI for you. I mean, is that where we're moving to? Like just hyper specialization? Or is there reasons to believe that that's not how the kind of the human mind works?
I mean, it's kind of interesting, right? Like, if we all go on a roller coaster, it's more or less the same experience. Okay. So we all want that experience because it brings us together. It binds us together. There's some sort of, you know, we did it, right? We buy the t-shirts. I rode the roller coaster or whatever, and, you know, I survived. We have more fragmentation going on with the way that we digest content. And at a point, it's not going to be cost effective to do that, right? And I think about this with movies. You know, with the glacial decline of movie attendance, I mean, think about it. We still need a lot of butts in seats for superhero movies. Those things are expensive.
Right.
So if we can't keep getting people in the door for these expensive things, we might have to pivot and think about how to kind of customize entertainment differently. But I also think to a certain point, you know, and you guys know this, it's possible to overtrain models. And when models are overfit, they decay and they become waste. And, you know, anything that is overly trained on an AI machine at a certain point also becomes useless after a while.
So true.
And so I think it's modification. And I think it goes back to what is the story that people want to tell? Bandersnatch on Netflix, which is a Black Mirror spinoff, was a choose your own adventure,
yes.
Right, guys? Like you were able to kind of see different permutations.
Right.
That was really central to a story about making a video game and seeing how different decisions could inform the game. I could see that being applied to that experience. But, you know, if I'm going to, I don't know, the DMV, I mean, would you really want to choose your own adventure with Anthony Palomba going to the DMV? That sounds awful.
But it's a very interesting principle because I think it holds true for, as you said, many other use cases of AI in which at some point, if we over-specialize and overfit, right, as the term is, overfit to an individual, it's going to become useless or not as well-received because it will be boring. Like, I can have the best show in the world, but then if I can't can't talk to my family, my friends, and everybody about it, then suddenly it becomes unrelatable and I no longer might find it interesting, right? I'm living my life. I don't need to watch it as well. So that's a really interesting observation. Anthony, this has been great.
Yeah, thank you so much. I mean, it's at that point now, Yael, where you and I have to make our choices.
Yes. So we're going to focus on the consumer side.
That's okay? Right.
Because I think we haven't really thought about it before this call. So like,
we talked about it mainly in terms of the artist.
Correct.
Before. So
correct.
If we think about it from the consumer, right. I'll ask you first. Okay. Is generative AI and all the things going along with it a good disruption, bad disruption, or no disruption?
Oh, definitely. I think it's a disruption. And I still stand on the side of good. I do believe that ultimately more selection, more awareness, more sophistication will lead to a better product at the end of the day. I think the TV and movies that we're seeing today by far superior on average to what we would see a long time ago because the technology has evolved. And I'm excited about the content of the future. I consume it a lot and I think I'm going to continue to consume it in high doses.
Yeah. You know, as often with me, I'm kind of on the fence on this one, even when it comes to consumer. In general, more content, more creative ability, lowering the cost of content, all of those should be wonderful for the consumer. The only thing that I have as a negative in the back of my mind is this idea of the endogeneity of preferences. And do we create...
What does that mean? That
and
sounds
what does
awfully
that mean
academic.
Is that very academic, that our preferences that we have can be shaped by the technology. And do we go to kind of the cat video becomes the content we consume because it is the easiest and it hits the right receptors in our brains here. That would be my only worry, that we think this flourishing of content is going to lead to more creative and interesting and diverse content, or does it lead to homogenization? I can't pronounce that word, and it's all kind of consuming. But I'm going to go on the positive side this time. I'm going to go good disruption for the consumer, with my little caveat and concern about where are we 10, 15 years from now.
I think one of our future podcasts and episodes should be focused on the human in the loop, Mike, because
yeah.
I think it relates a little bit to your concerns. I think that that's where we need to talk about judgment and how it kind of interacts and what we can do as thinking about disruption and technology, what we can do to really kind of identify how do we keep the judgment and the control in the hands of the humans.
I love it. I love it. So there'll be a future topic. Again, thank you to Anthony. Thank you, as always, to our producer, Gary, our lead researcher, Becky. I do want to end on one final note, which is I want someone on our listening crew, if you happen to put together Good Vibrations by Marky Mark Wahlberg.
But change it to Good Disruption.
Change it to Good Disruption. We'll deal with the IP issues later, but we're still looking for that theme song for our podcast there. So thank you very much.
It was nice chatting with you.
Good Disruption is a podcast from the University of Virginia Darden School of Business.